Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, a journey into mystery and a gateway to the mind of nature and the nature of mind. This is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, happy to be here with you so that together we can create a culture of wisdom, love, and beauty. Auspicious interbeing to you and yours, my friends, deep bow to Sophia, Cosmic Sophia, and Gaia Sophia, Guinos Hermes, don't want to forget my soul brother Hermes. I am excited to be here today, my friends. We have a very special guest. As usual, we are recording live in front of a celestial audience here at the Dangerous Wisdom Studios in the Maxa Regia, the Santa Cruz Mountains on Turtle Island. And I have a rock star. Now, I've had a rock star of love wisdom before, the great Bob Thurman, inimitable. But today's guest is pretty inimitable himself. I am super excited to be talking to a real wisdom brother, Cortland Dahl. I'm going to read you a little bit about his bio here. Dr. Cortland Dahl is a scientist, translator, author, and meditation teacher with a lifelong interest in the science of flourishing. My friends, we're going to talk about flourishing today, so get ready to feel the flourish. His journey began in early 1990s when he first learned to meditate. Aha! Wonder if that's a helpful thing to do. His passion led him on a journey around the world from monasteries in Burma to Zendos in Japan, as well as 8 years living in Tibetan refugee settlements in Nepal and India. During his travels, Dr. Dahl became fluent in Tibetan and became a prolific translator and scholar, receiving a master's degree in Buddhist studies and publishing 12 volumes of translations. He went on to study at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he was mentored by the renowned neuroscientist, good old Richie Davidson, and he received a PhD in mind, brain, and contemplative science, the first ever degree of its kind awarded by the university. He has since published numerous scientific articles, including a new scientific framework for the cultivation of well-being, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. That means it's free, friends. And we can put a link to that. It's a good article. I haven't gotten all the way through it. As part of his PhD dissertation, Dr. Dahl created the Healthy Minds Program, which is now a free mobile app that has been downloaded more than a million times and featured by the New York Times, Vogue, Sports Illustrated, and many other publications. More recently, he authored the book we're going to talk about, friends, A Meditator's Guide to Buddhism, and the forthcoming Born to Flourish, How to Thrive in a Challenging World. He's going to write that with Richie Davidson. He's a frequent public speaker, leads meditation retreats and courses on the science of flourishing around the world. He currently serves as executive director of Turgar International, which oversees a global network of meditation centers. That is good stuff, people. I highly, highly recommend that. I want to say, actually, just I'm going to say this, that what's so exciting about having Cortland here is that he is a translator in the most robust and holistic sense, someone following in the footsteps of the great philosopher Atisha, who didn't just translate text, but translated an entire spiritual tradition into another culture. And Cortland is doing that work for us. And so that's what this book is. It is a translation of incredible spiritual, we could call it spiritual technologies. That wouldn't be crazy in the Greek, deep Greek sense of technique. But this is the book, A Meditator's Guide to Buddhism. And Cortland Dahl is just really at the forefront of translating these deep spiritual teachings for our culture. Cort, wisdom brother, welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, man. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, and this is an auspicious time. You know, we've got, we're approaching equinox. It's coming, and we have a lunar eclipse. And you even have a quote about the eclipse of wisdom, which I really like that. This is, ignorance is like an eclipse. When the sun is eclipsed, there is no sunlight. When the moon is eclipsed, there is no moonlight. Likewise, when the mind is shrouded by ignorance, no knowledge can arise. And that's Leti Sayadaw. You have that quote in your book. Tell us, why do we need a meditator's guide to Buddhism?
You know, I think there's a lot of people out there who start meditating. They download an app, you know, and there's a million really, really good ways to get going these days, learning to meditate. And they make it very accessible. You know, you don't, it's not kind of covered with all the traditional stuff that is very esoteric or inaccessible to people. And I think there's a lot of people who at a certain point know that the path of meditation and these practices and ideas are helping them. They perhaps have had some taste of awakening, or if not that, at least, you know, just something meaningful in their lives. And then you get to this point where you're wondering where it all comes from and where to go next. And for some people, that might be something, you know, from the traditions from which they come, like Buddhism. For some people, it might be something else. And I realized there's not a lot of good books that are the kind of book you could just hand somebody at that point in their journey where they're wondering like, okay, I know this stuff comes from Buddhism. I don't know. I'm not necessarily interested in becoming Buddhist, but I just want to know more about this tradition. But they're not interested in the theory or philosophy or a purely academic exercise. They're coming to it more from a meditative point of view. So I was at that point at one point in my own meditative journey, and I think a lot of people are. In the Theragarh community, which you mentioned, we have a lot of people who reach that point. And I've designed courses and led retreats. And I always felt like we just never had that book, that first book that you can give somebody that just gives them the roadmap. And like, this is what this tradition is all about. Mm. Here's what you can expect. And here's how it differs from more secular forms of meditation. So I can't say that I succeeded, but that's really why I wrote it, was really to meet people at that point in the journey.
Mm. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. Now, and I want to let people know, I didn't emphasize this at the beginning, but I really should have, that you're working with one of the great, great, great yogis of our time, Mingyur Rinpoche, who is just an incredible teacher. I just really love the way he translates the tradition for us. Very accessible and just so accomplished. He's just a very special teacher, and you are very blessed karmically, my friend. It's wonderful, wonderful. And so that's part of what's coming through here. You can sense those teachings and the skill with which you did it. Everybody, I just want you to know, if there were a Buddhist kind of like solid, brought up in the Buddhist tradition teacher to check out, I think Mingyur Rinpoche is a good teacher to consider. And Court's book might be a way, like a bridge even to get to that. But it's a really wonderful resource. Now, I appreciate the way you're trying to characterize Buddhist philosophy. Why don't you go through what you say it's not, and maybe it is this. So will you go through what you think it's not, the two things you think it's not, and then what you think it is?
Yeah, you know, again, this goes back to my own personal journey. And I had kind of a funny experience in that I started meditating when I was around 19 years old. I was a college student. And I think it was maybe my freshman year of college, I wrote a paper on Buddhism. And I still remember being in the library. This is back in the days where you would literally go to physical books. And if anybody can remember what those days were like. And I remember picking out a book on Buddhism. I don't remember who wrote it or much about it, other than it was kind of an academic book. I subsequently wrote a paper for some introductory, you know, freshman class on Buddhism. That did nothing for me. Nothing awoke in me from doing that. I don't remember what the book said. It wasn't like, wow, this is amazing, I got to check this out. It was just my whatever. I wrote the paper and I moved on. It didn't speak to me. And I think it was because it was just an intellectual academic thing that didn't have a lot of heart. It didn't speak to direct experience. And to me, although there's ideas and philosophies, although it certainly is, you know, a lot of cultural rituals, there are these things in the tradition. I think at the end of the day, Buddhism has always meant to be a very practical exercise. It's a way to train and transform your mind. That's what it was for the Buddha himself when he first set out on his own journey. It's what he taught to others. So all the philosophies, all these other things, is it a religion? Is it a philosophy? You know, you can get into all sorts of, you know, academic squabbling about what those words even mean. But I don't think anybody would disagree with the heart of the tradition is about experience and about exploring experience, understanding experience, and through that, transforming experience. So that's what it's always been for me. And I think a lot of my own interest in what I've done professionally is just driven by that very personal interest I've had of wanting to explore my own mind and see what I learn.
Mm. Let me, to invite this, as a philosopher, I think what I have discovered, Thoreau put his finger on something over 100 years ago that was already an old problem in the dominant culture. He wrote, while he was on Walden Pond in his little retreat experience, he said, there are nowadays professors of philosophy, but not philosophers.
Hmm.
And I think it's important, actually, it seems to me important for our culture to recognize that what we face, there looks like there's all these, oh, there's an economic crisis, there's an ecological crisis, there's a crisis of attention, there's a crisis of loneliness. It's all a philosophical crisis. Because philosophy isn't about abstract speculation, but it literally means love. Love, wisdom, love. Mm-hmm. You love wisdom. Yeah. And love and wisdom are the two wings, right, that we're looking for. And, of course, Epicurus put it very clearly. Vain is the word of the philosopher that heals no suffering. It was always meant to be practical about transforming people and culture with heart. And so I think it's important maybe to recover. I appreciate that what you're doing is saying, oh, it's not that thing that you did in the university, because it isn't. It's not that thing, this is getting philosophical, but it is that thing about, do you love anything in your life? Would you like your life to go well? Do you want to understand who you are? And my friend Jeff Kripal,
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. You know, Jeff Kripal was down at Rice with Ann Klein, and, you know, I read his book, which is really wonderful, called The Superhumanities. I recommend it. It's really beautiful. But when he describes religion, I was like you. Court, if you read his book, everyone, you'll see Court was a little allergic to religion, like a lot of us are. And there's a kind of cultural PTSD in relation to religion, I think, a little bit. And also that relationship with science as now our dominant epistemology. But, you know, Jeff, he just says, well, you know what religions are about? Asking, who am I and how should I live? Well, that's just the basic philosophical question. So, and then I would also invite that philosophy is just how we do things. And philosophy, at the broadest scale, then, is how we do life. So it is a way of life. Yeah. But I do love that you emphasize the beautiful epistemology of this tradition, which is practice and realization. That's what its epistemology is, practice and realization, which makes it so akin to science, I think, in a beautiful way. Although there's people like to resist, you know, like Evan Thompson is a little nervous about saying things like that, but I don't think it's so bad. Okay, so can I ask you, though, in relation to that, okay, because there is this issue of we're in this culture a little nervous if I think we should be able to welcome a capacious sense of the religious heart, that it wants to know what really, who am I, what's my place, what's my purpose, and how I live. So then let it accommodate all those good people. But nevertheless, however we look at the Buddhist traditions, there seems to be a little bit of metaphysical tension between the way science is conventionally sort of habitually thought of, with metaphysical assumptions it doesn't like to simply acknowledge that it makes. Instead of it's just a metaphysical policing, that's not allowed. And do you sense a metaphysical tension between your practice and your study of the Buddhist traditions and some of what happens in science, and how do you navigate the territory there?
You alluded to some of my own history, which very much colors even how I look at these things today. I, as you said, I had a little bit of an allergy to religion. What that allergy was not necessarily so much to religion. I think it was to dogma of any kind. And this idea that what we should aim for is just having the correct belief system. And somebody was going to tell me, okay, here's what you should believe. And now you just believe that, and then you're good. That never sat well with me. And it doesn't sit well with me now, whether that's a Buddhist dogma or a scientific dogma or anything. And you find that everywhere. You find those competing strands in religious contexts. You find them in academic contexts. As you said, there's all sorts of assumptions, like the materialist assumption in the sciences. You know, I hang out with neuroscientists and work in a lab where we study the brain. And most neuroscientists would probably describe the mind as what the brain does. It's just an epiphenomenon of the brain. What is the evidence for that?
Right.
You know, nobody can give a good answer to that, you know, famously, the hard problem. And yet, people don't have a problem with just assuming that that's true, even in the absence of any clear evidence that it is. You find similar things in Buddhism. You find similar things really anywhere you find humans. There's going to be unquestioned assumptions. And you also find in those same worlds, in those same traditions, sometimes in the same person, the competing tendency where it's more about the question. It's more about the exploration. It's more about curiosity. And that's always been the part that brings me to life, brings my mind, sparks my own imagination, wakes me up in the morning. So to me, I don't really find them as tensions so much between science and religion, for example, as they are just these competing tendencies in our mind. Like there's just part of us that wants a solid ground to stand on and wants to just rest on, you know, what we think we know about the world. And there's this other part that's open and curious and wants to explore. And I've always just tried to nurture that part that's the open, curious side. And again, I'm a Buddhist fanatic by any, you know, you just look at my life and you could hardly have been more, you know, off the deep end in traditional Buddhism than I am. And yet, if you take some core Buddhist ideas, like, is there a rebirth? Is there, you know, some of these just basic Buddhist things? My honest answer would be, I don't know. Like, I trust some people, but do I really know? Honestly, no. There's a lot of things that I can't say I've validated experientially. But to me, that's not the important thing. It's not about, as I write in the book, it's the ideas are useful only insofar as they get you to look. They're not the end point.
Yes.
So that's the part that matters to me.
Yeah. And there, that's what, I mean, philosophy has always done, which is to say, okay, you've got a lot of bad beliefs. Let's get you ones that can orient you in the direction of truth. The beliefs that we're going to give you, the ideas we're giving you are not the truth, but they will help to turn your mind away from illusion and ignorance. You did something interesting in this book, which is to use the three, what are, of course, the standard word is jhana, but we can think of it as three vehicles. And you use that as a way to explain, as you put it, you know, here's the overview of what this tradition offers. Why did you choose those three? Why do you think that's a valuable way? Because, you know, like, you don't get that in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind. You don't get that in some of these. It's a really beautiful thing to see someone working with something so traditional. Tell us what's important about it.
Yeah, again, it goes back to my original motivation in writing this book. And as I said, I think there's this point where people are wanting the roadmap of what is this all about? Where is it going? How do all the pieces fit together? Also for people who've been practicing a long time, even who might have been deeply immersed in the tradition, it's easy to forget about really what is it all about. You get so lost in all the details that sometimes you just need to be reminded, what is this all about? Why am I doing all of this? And it could be helpful to zoom out. So I think for both those periods, it can be a helpful thing. So the three jhanas are one way to map out the architecture of the Buddhist tradition, in particular from the point of view of the way it's laid out in Tibet. And that mirrors a particular point in the evolution of Buddhism in ancient India as well. So when Buddhism spread from India to Tibet, this was kind of shortly before the Muslim invasions that eventually wiped out Buddhism from within India. There'd been many developments and permutations of Buddhism over the centuries. And there were times where there was kind of a fragmentation, where there are all sorts of different lineages and approaches and time of great diversity. And then there was a period of synthesis where it was like, okay, well, how does all this fit together? How can we bring the best of all of these strands of Buddhism that have evolved and put them all together into one coherent path? That period of synthesis is what made its way to Tibet. And the way that Tibetans understand the architecture of awakening that draws on all of these different strands of Buddhism that had developed is through these three jhanas, these three different approaches where they're practiced together. It's not like you pick one of the three. It's more three different ways to construct the path that all have something unique to say about experience, but that could be combined in a really unique, powerful way. So again, it goes back to just how do you think about this tradition and how can you make sense of all the different ideas, the different practices, the different meditations in a way that hopefully helps people both understand what it's all about and see how the pieces fit together. Mm-hmm. The last thing I would say is that, you know, the Tibetan tradition, I sometimes joke that it's like the anti-Zen. The strength of Zen is its simplicity, right? Like, it's just this laser-like simplicity. Tibetan Buddhism is the overwhelm you with options tradition, which is beautiful because you can find in that something that really speaks to you. It's not a cookie cutter, one size fits all kind of thing, but it can be overwhelming because there are many forms of practice, many different ideas, and you need to make sense of that. So this was basically to help people navigate all of that richness.
Yeah. So for anybody who's not familiar with this, the idea is the teachings went through three phases of evolution, and there are different discussions about why that might have been, not least of which that, you know, when Buddha comes out of the forest, he doesn't say, everything's bliss. He starts out by talking about something else. And the way I sometimes caricature this, and you might appreciate caricatures bear a resemblance, but they're a caricature. It's like he comes out and says, okay, everybody, the problem is craving. And then there's a second round that says, actually, the problem is ignorance. And then finally, there's a round that says, actually, the problem is there's no problem.
And so, problem is you think there's a problem.
Yeah. Well, exactly. There's no problem, but you think there is. And Buddha doesn't start there. And it's like, as you know, the part of the tradition story is that he said, don't tell everybody the other things because they turn out to be very challenging. Once, you know, but each time he's giving us a way out, there's liberation in each of the phases. It looks different. As you say, there are different practices, the destination, like how, what we think we're doing varies a little bit. But what you're providing is the synthetic view of all of that taken together as like the real healthy vehicle that we can use to get to where we want to go, which is wisdom, love, and beauty, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, it's an amazing journey, the way it's constructed. Sometimes I just marvel at the like, who came up with this? Like, this is, it's just, it's really brilliant. Yeah. And even from a scientific point of view, some of these things are so, I mean, they so mirror what we're learning about how the brain operates. And that to me is just amazing. Like, how did people stumble upon these methods? I mean, just like one simple example, our human nature is so often to focus on the negative. And there's important biological and even evolutionary reasons for that. You know, if nothing else, we just needed to be good at detecting threats and detecting aberrations in our environment to survive. So there's reasons why we do that. And it's natural to do that. And yet, from the point of view of growth and even just being less stressed out and having better mental health, that is obviously not something that does us any favors, those predispositions. And so we know scientifically that to focus on the positive, a strengths-based approach, for example, is much more effective. And you can see in even Olympic athletes, you know, they don't imagine everything that could go wrong and what they'll do if it does. They imagine the perfect race. They imagine doing whatever they do to perfection. That's exactly what a lot of these practices that you find in the tradition, that's not, oh, I have these problems and how do I fix them? It's you imagine yourself in the perfected state, or you tap into those strengths and then you orient to them. So anyways, it's just fascinating to me how that whole path is constructed and how brilliant some of these ancient ideas are. And we're just beginning to understand them from a scientific point of view.
Yeah. I every time I read the Pali Canon, I am struck by the sheer genius of this guy. Like, if there's any, set aside anything else about what the meaning of Buddha is, this is an incomparable philosopher. I mean, he is the philosopher par excellence who knows the mind, gives you all of this, all of these teachings. It's extraordinary. And there is a reason why we put the Buddhist practitioners in brain scanners and why some scientists use the teachings to guide their research. Well, that's what Buddha said. Let's do it. And then you run the experiment. You say, well, there it is. There's something going on here that we haven't seen before. And that's amazing that has happened. Let me ask about something in relation to this. Maybe this is a place. I don't know if this is a place to get to. So, because there's something. Maybe I could get at this by noting everybody has to, when talking about Buddha, I think, it's very common to tell Buddha's story. And it's archetypal and powerful. And then everybody's got to make decisions about how they tell the story. And I'm going someplace with this, but I'm just going to use like as an example. And maybe if there's a future edition, you might even think about how you told the story on the basis of what I'm going to suggest. Because it's not just, right now, one of the mistakes that we have in cognitive science is that we are localizing it to the brain and we're not necessarily thinking in a different way. And so when you told the story of Buddha, there were two elements, and I love the way you told it. This is not like some kind of strong criticism, but I did notice two people missing. Kantaka, Buddha's horse, was not in the story. And Sujata, she wasn't in the story. And they seem so archetypally significant now because of the fact that the horse still has this powerful symbolic presence. And it's an interspecies connection. The horse carries Buddha into the liminal space. That's who carries him into the liminal space, loves him so much that he dies after, is reborn, becomes a student, and becomes enlightened. Then, where is Kantaka? Well, in the middle of the flag, right in the mandala flag, there's the lungta, still there, still representing what was deeply present in that image. Then Sujata, she thinks the Buddha is a tree spirit. What a powerful thing that she thinks he's a tree spirit, and what does he do? He sits on Mother Earth. And you've seen maybe the art depicting this goddess holding Buddha while he's meditating there. She is supporting his awakening. And because I know this is also, I'm going to take the thread just a little further, and I promise not to just keep rambling, but this is also a connection. I know you've been talking about modern ways to discuss kleshas. And I think that's beautiful. Kleshas, for anybody who hasn't heard this word, it's like kinks in the flow of our being. That's what the suffering is, the kinks, when we get kinked up. And then love wisdom is unkinking. And the flow of our being is freed. And we see that we were liberated all along and we were just self-kinking mistakenly. Okay. So now the classic kleshas are still important, like ignorance. That's okay, important klesha. But then you are talking about social division as a klesha. But there, too, what about ecological division or eco-social? Why not even call it eco-social division? Because we have this, like, terrible... It's almost as if we need so deeply to integrate spiritual fluency with ecological fluency. Like, as if it's far worse. Textual illiteracy is far less a problem than ecological illiteracy, although I don't like to make it a textual thing. Everything's text, but no. So eco-fluency and spiritual fluency, because that's what you're doing with this book, is you are improving the spiritual fluency of the culture by, like, leaps, because this is such an accessible, beautiful book. But then also, it seems like if we don't deliberately say, well, this is a serious klesha, and our whole spiritual life is being practiced on the basis of fossil fuels, we're riding on consumer culture. And if we don't directly integrate it, if we don't stop saying just pro-social, but wait a minute, pro-eco-social, what are you guys doing to kind of begin to maybe integrate some of that? Because I think it's so important. The final thread I'll pull, and maybe I will touch it later, is the work of Bateson, where he would say that to think that brains produce mind is a mistake. Minds are ecologies. And it's yet another reason why we somehow have to bring these streams together. Any thoughts about any of that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think you're picking up on a conversation that we're having. I've got a book that I'm working on with Mingyur Rinpoche and Richie Davidson, that the three of us are writing a book together. And I think what you're referring to is that one of the, we actually have a series of dialogues that we're using as a kind of a way to think through the book. One of the topics with this idea of the modern klesha or the 21st century kleshas, one of the areas is division. And it's interesting that you mentioned that, because originally, actually, that was exactly how we had framed it, is division, which can be social division. It can be, as you're kind of saying, ecological division. Like, we're just sort of feeling separate from and cut off from the environment and the climate, et cetera. And we ended up thinking that it might be better to have that as a theme that's woven throughout all of the kleshas, versus being something that's like purely like social division is kind of its own thing. And it's having its moment, so to speak, because it's just such a painful moment in so many, not just here in the US, but so many countries, there's similar things happening. And so we wanted to be able to focus the discussion, and we wanted to call out how the environmental crisis also, it kind of cuts across all of these different elements, all of the things we're talking about, even something like distraction, like all of the things kind of play out, both affect and are affected by our relationship to the environment. and the world that we live in. So we're still working on this. Actually, I think there's still a chance we might weave that together in one chapter, or we might kind of have it as a thread that we touch upon in all of the chapters. But the point is that I totally agree that is kind of a really important theme, and one of the most important ways that we think about this ancient idea of the klesha, a mental emotional disturbance in the modern world. Like, this is how that's playing out. I'd say we're still at the beginning of thinking about how we want to have that discussion.
Yeah. Well, I do encourage you. I mean, one of the things I don't know if you remember this passage from the Dalai Lama, but this is in his book, A Call for Revolution. He said, "I've been inspired by the ideas of the French Revolution that were adopted as the motto of the French Republic, liberté, égalité, fraternité. I adopted the same motto. As a Buddhist, the aim of my spiritual quest is to free myself of the fundamental ignorance that has led to the notion that there is a division between people and the natural world, which is the root of all our suffering." So that is an example of really bringing the spiritual, because there's like a spiritual commons that you're touching. I think it's analogous to an ecological commons, because what you're saying, which is beautiful, that Buddhist practice can accommodate. If you're a Christian, stay a Christian. That's okay. But you can still learn, because there's a commons here that we can all drink from. We can share this, even though we might have our own practices, and similar to an actual river that we have to care for. And that non-duality of the spiritual and ecological, I think he's really touching in a beautiful way. But the way it also would touch on the science is what Bateson, you know, when Bateson went to, he gave a talk at Naropa, your alma mater, and he said... So he's at Naropa, and you got to think somebody is explaining some things to him, right? And he says, "In the last few days, people have asked me, what do you mean by ecology of mind?" Because his definition of mind, which is a careful, rigorous scientific definition, is the same definition that you would have for mind. And so anything that meets these criteria that Bateson laid out, which are very close to, you know, Evan and Francisco's work, on very similar criteria. So he said, "In the last few days here at Naropa, people have asked me, what do you mean by ecology of mind? Approximately what I mean is the various kinds of stuff that go on in one's head and in one's behavior and in dealing with other people and walking up and down mountains and getting sick and getting well. All that stuff interlocks and in fact constitutes a network, which in the local language here at Naropa is called mandala." So he says, "I'm more comfortable with the word ecology, but they're very closely overlapping concepts." What do you think of this? I mean, you know, like we really, it's as if part of recognizing how correct Buddha was is to recognize something about that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's true. I mean, the mandala principle and just the, you know, the basic idea of interdependence, it is such a rich idea to work with and experience. I mean, like even like right now, the intuitive kind of feeling we have is just, I'm here, the world is out there. It's all like we're just these kind of autonomous beings that are just moving through space and time and bumping up against each other. And this invites a totally different perspective. Like, I mean, even right now, looking at this experience, you know, the me right now is inseparable from seeing you, hearing you, my environment, all of this stuff just is the me in this moment. Like, I can't separate out, you know, what I'm hearing and what I'm seeing from the I or the me that might feel independent of all of that. And so I think it is this incredibly rich interplay of all sorts of internal and external factors that are shaping and being shaped by each other. And it's just not the intuitive way that we kind of our knee-jerk, like instinctual thought about things or belief about the world. But yet it's just it's a radically different way. And I, you know, both the mandala principle and, you know, even the term ecology invites that kind of perspective, that it's more rich, more complex, many more things interrelated with each other than what we normally think.
Yeah. Yeah, because, well, the last place I'll touch on this is just there, too, a place where I super appreciate the notion that the Buddhist tradition invites us to go inward. And you have the phrase of cultivating a rich inner life. But mm-hmm. but here, this ecological principle says we just need to cultivate the richness of life without the split, because of the fact that the natural world is part of what we... And so it's almost like I'm saying, maybe we have to move toward, instead of a householder yogi, a homesteader yogi. And that even the person in their Manhattan apartment can be a homesteader yogi who's trying to engage in the practice of re-indigenizing themselves. They could have their micro sprouts growing. They could try to spend time in nature, right? But we know that these traditions... The Zen tradition, which you began in, and I did too, and but also, you know, so you don't just have the Zen tradition just really shows us the sacredness of nature, right? And how this is the sutra. The mountain and the river are the sutra, but Longchenpa does this, Shabkar, all of them say this is the very direct teaching. So I'm just, this is like a kind of, I think, just it's something very present to my mind very much, you know, how we need to really actively bring these things together. But how do you say we really begin our spiritual life? Setting aside all these larger questions, for you, what is the real beginning of, okay, I'm going to become a meditator, really?
I think the simplest starting point is you just look. You just simply begin to look at your own mind and your own experience. And that's, you mentioned this phrase, the developing an inner life. I think that was it for me when I first started meditating. Of course, you could talk about all the different techniques, and there's a million of them. I mean, there's so many ways to meditate, and some are complex, some are very simple. But I think the important thing is not really the technique. It's that you're no longer taking your experience as a given. You're actually beginning to get curious about your own mind. It's like a little kid out in the forest who's just filled with awe and wonder and curiosity, and just, you know, you just can pick up a leaf and look at it for an hour, like that kind of mentality. And we are so endlessly pulled into the external world in a kind of mindless way. We all know this, like, you know, even if you're, I mean, there's probably very few people on the planet, even people who are meditators and very intentional, who are not pulled into their devices, right? Like, we've, like, just a lot of money and creativity has gone into creating things that hijack our attention and keep our attention locked, you know, in whether it's, you know, Netflix or our cell phone or social media. There's a million different things. And this was never easy for humanity. I mean, you could look in the Buddha's writings or the Buddha's teachings 2,500 years ago, and clearly people were distracted then. It's not like distraction is a new thing. But we've taken that to a whole new level. And I think that simple turn towards one's own mind and inner experience. And you're right, it's not, the whole meditative path isn't about going within. But I do think, because it's a blind spot for a lot of us, it's an important starting point. Because we have a world that creates a kind of an impoverishment of our inner lives.
Yes.
So I think that's more important than whatever the technique of meditation might be. It's that you're just starting to pay attention to yourself, your emotions, your thoughts, even your body, all these different things that we normally are just kind of tuned out to and distracted.
Yeah, that's the basic gesture of love wisdom, is care, attend, to attend.
Yeah.
You know, that's what Socrates really taught us, that we are here to attend to the sacred, attend to what we really are. And it's a beautiful image. I wonder, too, see, there, too, I think what's beautiful is if we do them both at the same time, we know that we can see our own mind in the impoverishment of the world. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things that Plato wanted to say, is that you can blow the soul up. You know, you're looking inside for it. But he gives us an image of the soul when he teaches about the republic. He's teaching about the ideal republic. But that's a republic of the soul. It's a metaphor. It's saying you can't see this invisible thing. But just look at, if you want to know what your mind is, just look at the oil spill. That's our mind, and bringing them together. It even makes me sometimes concerned about you sort of touched on this a little bit. There is this general narrative. I'm going to give the caricature version of it. Okay, Fred comes in to talk to me as a consulting philosopher, and I say, Fred, you're very anxious, right? Yes, I'm very anxious. I say, okay, now here's the thing. The reason is your ancestors, when they were wandering around and someone heard a sound, it could be a tiger, you know, so you're naturally, you're on edge and you're paying attention, but it's only an email, Fred. Don't worry. There's no tigers. So now you can calm down because that old thing is just not helpful in this context. And I think, okay, yes, I get why we want to tell that story. But here's what I wonder. You said yourself that energy is supposed to trigger me to begin to look for whether there's something anomalous. And I might think, oh, it's the email. Or what if it's the fact that there are no tigers? What if it's the fact that there's plastic in my blood and heavy metals in my bones? And so don't we there too need to really make sure we have wisdom and discernment, because otherwise we might calm ourselves down and meditate our way into the catastrophe rather than realizing, no, actually there was a reason that you were feeling some anxiety, even if we calm it down, but to say that, well, yeah, all these things are happening and your system might be saying, wait, where are all the animals? Where are all the, why is it that I'm drinking water that tastes like this? And what, you know, I mean, there's a lot that maybe we should be sensitive to and take it as a gift, not just the teacher to teach me how to be free from anxiety, but the teacher that's teaching me what's wrong with the larger ecologies of mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point. You know, if you just, this is perhaps going to be a somewhat overly simplistic analysis, but I do think there's some truth to it. What, you know, what we evolved to do, we didn't evolve to be happy, right? We evolved to survive. That, you know, it didn't matter how happy you were or were not. That is not what determined whether your genes were passed down. It's like, were you alive on day two and day three and day four? And those are the people who survived.
Unless happiness had survival value.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. Yes. So anything, I mean, those only were, you know, hereditary traits that were passed down insofar as they helped us survive. So if being happy helped us survive, you know, there's some evidence that maybe it did. Like we, you know, if, you know, it probably is helpful to some degree. And the, you know, evolution is also very slow. It's not like in a single generation you have this radical change. And so it presents a problem in that for most of human history, things in the external world were changing very slowly.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't like some massive change from one generation to the next. But look at what's happened in our single lifetime. The advent of the internet, and then the advent of mobile devices, and the advent of social media, and now the advent of artificial intelligence. I mean, all these things have developed and completely changed how humanity functions. And evolution does not work that fast, not even close. You know, it doesn't work even close to that fast. And so it creates an issue in that our evolutionary wiring is just not set up to be good at determining what is or is not going to be adaptive, what will or will not help us survive. Mm. It's set up for the previous environment, was, you know, a number of generations back. And so if you look at, if from that point of view, you can see that, yeah, for most of human history, that ability to detect physical threats in the environment, you know, is there a dangerous animal? Like, is there a snake or a spider or a bear? Or even like food, you know, like poisonous food. Like we're, you know, we have these instinctual responses because those were the threats for, you know, the main threats. Now we have a very different set of threats. And our body doesn't necessarily know, our nervous system doesn't necessarily know what to do with these sort of non-existential, non-physical threats, but we respond as though they are. You know, somebody, you know, sends us a, you know, doesn't like our post on Instagram, you know, and or some puts a nasty comment to something we post in Twitter. And like, our, you know, our nervous system was never built for this kind of situation. Like what happens, you know, it's not somebody we have a close personal relationship with, we don't have any trust. And then suddenly we're taking in some information that triggers some kind of threat response. But there's nowhere to flee to. There's nobody to fight in a physical sense. Freezing, there's no resolution if you freeze. So the evolutionary responses we have don't function in that environment, which is why we have chronic stress, because they're not resolvable situations. You know, if it's a snake, you can run away, you can freeze, you can try to fight it, I suppose. That's probably not a good option, but it's going to be resolved one way or another. Either you win or you run away or something happens. But with the kind of stuff that happens to us, that's not true. And similarly, with the things you're talking about, with microplastics, with environmental pollution, with, you know, a million different things like that, our nervous system really is not set up for these kind of threats. It hasn't evolved to help us cope with these kinds of threats. So clearly, if what meditation did was just make us passive and, like, you know, we're just going to be kind of happier and more equanimous as the world burns, that would obviously not be, you know, it might be good in the short term. Obviously, that's not what we need as a species. But yeah. I like to think that this is, it's like you said earlier, it's equipping us with wisdom and compassion. And would, when we're facing monumental challenges, whether they're personal challenges or species level challenges or even global challenges or all of the above, would you rather be driven by toxic emotions and chronic stress, or would you rather be powered by wisdom and compassion, the ability to see clearly and to really deeply care without getting overwhelmed? And then it's like, yeah, then I don't know. To me, it seems pretty obvious. I mean, people oftentimes critique teaching meditation in the military. And I know, like, Amishi Jha is a friend of mine. She's done all this work teaching mindfulness in the military. And she's gotten a lot of flack for that. And I just ask, I mean, I'm not doing this. I have no dog in this, you know, in this fight at all. Yeah. But really, would you rather them not be taught how to be wise and compassionate? Like, is that better for the world? You know, like, even if you disagree with the military and the whole agenda, but is the solution to withhold teachings that are going to make people wise, more wise and more caring? Is that somehow, I mean, I think we should ask questions and it's certainly worthy of dialogue, but I don't know. To me, it seems like a pretty easy answer when you think about it from that point of view.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of the trick that I think we're getting at, is that there's a certain, you know, Bob Thurman emphasizes just this a lot, the fact that there, in order for meditation to work, there has to be a certain grounding of what people are thinking they're going to make real. Because obviously, whatever the reality is beyond words, but you're still, there still is a making real. And so I think that's such an interesting question. If, like, so even to just take this, this is going to be released on YouTube. I, of course, want this to be on YouTube under the auspices of thinking that this will somehow help the culture. But I think I make a mistake if I believe that I'm using YouTube to do good. YouTube is still primarily using me. Right. So the system is using all of us, and I think it's in part this question of what, how, what is the nature of the teaching that we will, like, the ecology we build around meditation will be an ecology of realization. What the fruits are going to depend on that ecology that we create, and all manner of spiritual materialism has got to be coming in. Right. Whenever we engage, when we take these risks, you go into Google, the company who no longer says don't be evil is one of our mottos. Let's just take that off. We don't want to say that anymore. So you know that there's some way in which there's going to be a tension. But you're right. It seems wise to at least try to navigate it the best we can. But I guess it's just, you know, maybe keeping the dialogue open. I mean, that's part of why I think considering the philosophical dimension is just unavoidable, because it's going to be this question of, well, how do we do this? How do we do it? We can't just have a practice that doesn't have anything. Bob Thurman always likes to say that we're trying to build the fourth floor without the first three, right? He's always, it's his thing. Anyway, so I don't know. It's nuanced. I'm with you. And yes, it's better, all things considered, if we have some support. And then the question is, how do we together help each other to see clearly these larger things that are so nuanced? Because the interwovenness, as a core teaching, Buddha said, look, it's just subtle and profound, and that's what it is. It's, if it were simple, I would just tell you, it's interwoven, and you're done, right? Yeah. Okay, so another thing that I wanted to ask you about in relation to this, too, have you looked at all at the Earth Charter? Because that's a very profound and unique civil society document that was produced over a decade of dialogue and effort. The Dalai Lama participated, other spiritual leaders, scientists, political leaders, indigenous peoples. And it was about creating an ethical framework that that would allow us to sense our common ground and to root us in what we could call ethical and ecological integrity. It's a really beautiful, a lot of institutions, many, many thousands of institutions have sort of aligned themselves with the basic principles. But it is a way to think about how to extend the common ground into something that's ecological. And it has this very famous line about how in order for us to evolve as a human culture, that we're going to have to learn how to emphasize being more rather than having more. Mm-hmm. And just that phrase of the being more, which is it's really beautiful. And, you know, compassion is in there because of His Holiness. And there were so many debates about how to put compassion in there. Just a lot of work went into it. And it's not very long. It's short. It has four basic principles, but they're really worth considering. And it's something that maybe as you continue to research or think about ways forward, it could be a framework that could help in one way, shape, or form. But it's a totally secular civil society document. Just throwing that out there, Court.
And I love the focus on being. In fact, it was interesting. I just published an article in Psychology Today just a couple of weeks ago on the looking at shifting from doing to being.
Yes.
Almost as a skill you can practice. And I mean, it's sort of hard to use language because it's like a non-practice, but without getting into the issues with language. And it was interesting. I published a lot of kind of articles and things like that. That one really struck a chord. I was just really interested to see how much that resonated. And I think it's just because we live in this world where we're just always on. I mean, now with devices, I mean, so many people, including myself, it's like, it's so easy to wake up, grab your phone, you go to sleep, grabbing your phone. I mean, I've been meditating for 30 years and you'd think I'd be immune to this stuff. I learned pretty early on, I have to leave my phone out of my room. Like I don't bring my phone into my bedroom because I just noticed if I just had it sitting next to me, it's just so easy. It's just like, you know, it's like crack. It's just so easy, like so easy. So,
yeah.
And that's how so many people live. I've got a 19-year-old son and I can just see that whole generation, their devices, like they don't know what it's like to switch off. I think a lot of people in the world. And so it's almost like you don't even know what to do. Like you know, it doesn't feel good. You know, it's depleting. And yet what do you actually do? So that whole, the whole contrast of doing versus being and how you get familiar with being. And then how, this is going to sound a little weird for people who aren't familiar with this from a meditative point of view, how you can have the doing happen within a state of being. At the beginning, you need to make space for being to kind of be grounded there. And at a certain point, like you could see this in great meditation masters, they can be very active. I mean, the Dalai Lama, I mean, he's incredibly active.
Totally.
But you can just sense the quality of being that they never lose touch with that.
Yeah.
So it's not as though you're just sitting around staring off into space all day. It's actually, you can be incredibly active, but there's just this inner space that you're always connected to.
Yeah,
that,
well,
yeah, Lao Tzu. That takes practice.
Right, Lao Tzu said, when we do things, we leave many things undone. But by means of non-doing, everything is accomplished. And so that's really that space. It's that non-doing is happening.
Yeah.
And it's a deep and profound switch. And we need it, you're right. And we have lost, I sometimes think that if you watch Avatar the movie, there's a great ecological message there, but there's one thing that's misleading, that you have to understand that unobtainium is your mind, and it's being mined all the time. It's being extracted. That the whole thing is to extract mind from us, really, our attention. Mm-hmm. It has to be on the project at work, and then it has to be on the Netflix screen with Amazon Next so that you can open that and order. And our very mind is being extracted And we're really not aware of it. That's why we're always on, because we're plugged in, like in the Matrix. That's another way to think of it. It's all of our minds. You go to the gas station now and you pump your gas and there's a show. There's a screen.
I know. It's kind of amazing.
Like, yeah, even the space between having the price at the grocery store and signing. It's like in those 3 seconds, they have to flash you a commercial because we have to own this bit of your attention too.
Yeah.
And we have, it's almost like you're off, your book is a great act of rebellion, as all the philosophers have always been. It is to rebel against the insanity and try to find truth, reality, peace.
And even meditation, I mean, that's, there's a risk that meditation is just one more thing to do. And you bring all of that compulsive doing energy into meditation, contemplative practices. So for me, the being is actually the core of the whole thing. And I remember when I first started meditating, I also was doing yoga. I kind of started doing hatha yoga and meditation at around the same time. And I had this part of my daily routine that was actually so helpful at the time. I was a college student. I had a lot more flexibility. You know, it's harder when you've got kids and a busy job and stuff like that. But at that time I was 19, 20, in my early 20s and meditating a lot. And I would meditate in the morning when I woke up. And then in the afternoon, right before dinner, I had a little ritual where I would do hatha yoga for like 45 minutes. And then I would do shavasana, like the corpse just lying on the ground for 45 minutes. So like half of my yoga, like my, was actually just lying on the ground doing nothing.
Yeah.
And doing nothing, I think, I was meditating and twice a day and doing hatha yoga. I think actually lying and doing nothing was actually the most transformative part of what I learned and still to this day carry with me, was actually just that, like nothing. Like I don't need to be getting more concentrated or more anything. Mm. This is just being, because we've erased all the cultural rituals in our world, especially in the modern West, around being. They were there. I mean, we've had them. You can go to, my wife is Japanese. You can go to Japan. They still have, tea drinking and, there's all sorts of rituals that are really just around being. But we've kind of obliterated them from our world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The closest we get is binge watching our favorite show or like the really, yeah. I mean, it's not being, it's just losing ourselves in something.
It's a crisis of the soul, because I think any seriously democratic culture has to provide that deliberately. There has to be an amendment of the soul that you have the right to find out what you are, which means you have the right to have time to do nothing. And that is not what we are allowed, I mean, the Australians even are ahead of us because they passed a law that said work has no right to contact you when you're not at work. So that's it. They're not even allowed to ask you, will you receive calls or emails? It's nope. It is a right that I get to clock out. And so how do we recover that? And how do we recover actual real ritual and liminal spaces? Because, there's this idea that all we have are liminoid spaces and sort of thin imitations of ritual. The technical term liminoid means that it's like, some of the research on liminality and initiation. So the idea is that we used to have real liminal spaces, initiatory spaces, and that they were a sort of cauldron of being, because a new kind of being could emerge from it, because you were engaged in the activity of cultivating that being, touching its fullness. And so we have liminoid spaces. It's like if you compare a spiritual pilgrimage with the average vacation, we try to use the vacation or the road trip as a liminal space, as a way to have the conviviality and the kind of personal transformation and insights, but it's such a thin replica or facsimile of a real liminal space that it limits the capacity for meaning to shift. I mean, that's really that's another way to think of the kleshas, is that they, ecologies depend not on a flow of physical energy. This is one of Bateson's beautiful ideas, is that we talk about physical forces and we talk about power. And even in politics, there's this idea of power dynamics. And he said, no, power is only a metaphor. Ecologies depend on a flow of meaning, because minds work with meaning, not with physicality. And the same physical energy can have radically different meanings. And so what the kleshas are then is constrictions about what is the meaning of my life and what's the meaning of my being, what's the meaning of my identity. I am doing that, and real ritual and real liminal experience open more possibility for meaning. So it's a terrible thing to have lost.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And there's such a hunger for it. I mean, and like I said, just this article or in the Healthy Minds app or things we do at Tergar, I just hear endlessly people connect, for example, with the practice of open awareness, which is almost like meditation on being, you know, meditation as being or being as meditation. Mm-hmm. And people, even if it's like people don't know what to do, you can just see that there's such a deep hunger. It kind of strikes such a deep chord within us. And yet it's very challenging. I mean, there's research showing that college students, if you put them in a room and you just ask them to sit there and do nothing, and you put a little contraption where they can administer shocks to themselves, most students will choose to shock them, to inflict pain on themselves rather than just sitting there.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, and it's just telling. A big wake-up call for me was about 10 years ago, I was moving and I like moving houses, like moving to a new place. And I had hired a college student just to help unpack like boxes. Like I had got a U-Haul and I remember he was carrying boxes out to this U-Haul, putting in the U-Haul and then just walking back to get more boxes. And it was literally like 20 steps. And in that 20 steps, he was taking his phone out. And I was like, I remember just watching him like, you don't even have time to take the phone out and do anything with it. It's like, there's not even, but he couldn't just literally walk 20 steps without filling the space with something. I mean, it was, it was like a bad movie. I'm like, if somebody had told me that, I would have like, no, that's like, it doesn't even make sense. Like you don't even have time to use your phone in that period. But yet it was just so telling of this modern era we live in. And so many people, the other thing I hear all the time as a meditation teacher is people say, well, I started to meditate and my mind was just so agitated. It was so filled with thoughts. I was so distracted that I just thought this isn't for me. I'm not good at this. And I'm like, that's like getting on the treadmill and getting tired after 5 steps and thinking, oh, well, exercise is not for me because I'm getting too tired. Like that's the evidence that you need to meditate, not the evidence.
Right. Well, and also the common thing that we tell people when we teach meditation, right, is that, well, that's, you're just noticing what your mind was like.
Yeah.
It's not but it's very common for people to say, no, every time I try to meditate, my mind just gets so busy. And it's, no, you just actually looked at it for the first
time.
That's
like you noticed that your mind was busy, not that your mind suddenly became distracted.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
And actually, that's such that it feels painful. It's kind of a painful realization.
Yeah.
And yet, actually, that is so, that's a seismic shift in inner experience. That's the beginning of the inner life. Just to notice what's going on in your own mind.
Yeah.
So although it's painful, you know, it's like you've been sitting on the couch eating Cheetos your whole life and suddenly you start having some healthy meals and then you eat Cheetos again. You're like, oh, I don't feel good eating this.
Yeah.
Like that contrast actually is really important. And that's suddenly you realize something. It's probably just how you felt generally before.
Yeah.
But now you have a contrast. Now you actually pay attention to how it's affecting you versus it's just your baseline and you don't even recognize what it feels like.
Yeah. One of my favorite examples of what you're talking about is I was watching a documentary about this guy who's a free climber. He's like one of the best free climbers in the world. And so that means he's up on sheer rock faces with no lifeline. If he falls, he dies.
If not that movie, I can hardly even watch that. Like, I don't know how that's just mind-boggling.
But what I love is this guy, he actually says in the documentary, a lot of people might think I'm crazy to be out there on that cliff face where any wrong move and I could be dead, but I'd rather be on that cliff face than in here alone with my own mind.
Yeah.
He actually said that. And it also, for me, I have to say I'm like a little bit of an anti-flow philosopher because I think we've gotten flow crazy and I think it's very confused, but it really shows I bet he's in flow. But there is no spiritual development that's happening there. I really think all the flow talk, we have to shift into something a little bit deeper.
Yeah, we talk a lot about flow, actually. In fact, that's a whole interesting topic. You know, Richie Davidson and I in our work, like flow always comes up. It's almost like clockwork every time, especially when we talk about meta-awareness, which is one of the main scientific phenomena that we investigate in relation to meditation and these practices. People always want to know about flow. Like, what is that? Is that flow or what is that? And the take home, I would say, the key point is that there is flow. We use the term flow, but actually there is flow with and without meta-awareness, using the scientific term.
Sure.
Because if you look at, for example, Japan is a great example. All the arts, if you can think of calligraphy, poetry, archery, even there's a tradition of flower arranging.
Yes.
There's all these disciplines that are the arts, really, but they are considered meditative disciplines. And so there's states of flow where you have trained to integrate the flow with the state of heightened awareness, or what scientists would call meta-awareness. But you're absolutely right. The normal state of flow that most people enter into is contextual, meaning it's dependent on a particular environmental context.
Yes.
And it's triggered. And it's a state of absorption, really.
Yeah.
It's not a state of heightened awareness. It's a state of, it's a dimming of awareness in many ways. You're kind of lost
exactly.
in the experience.
That's it.
Versus your heightened, you have a heightened presence.
Yeah.
But you can use those things with some intentionality, as they do in the Japanese arts, for example.
It's very different.
Many meditative traditions.
It's very different because it's not just the meta-awareness, but it is on a path of wisdom and love. It's directed, it's intentional as well. It's not just, to caricature Chitsu Mihai's finding, he basically discovered that when you do something you enjoy yourself. And what that does is there's an analogy to the way MDMA works with PTSD. We know that compassion training can help people with PTSD. But if you don't have that training, the MDMA puts your mind in the space of positivity and you can now metabolize the experience. But you have not been taught anything about the nature of your own mind.
Mm-hmm,
I'm painting and I like painting puts my mind in a space of concentration, but I have not learned how to concentrate my own mind or anything about the nature of my mind. So it gets held by an activity because I happen to like the activity. But it's almost meaningless, and spiritually it's different. I think it's an important place for us to try to help people, because there's like flow addiction, and there's like all this kind of coaching around creating flow states. But also, when you lack wisdom, it just means that I've given you tools to stabilize your mind to do things that may not be particularly wise or compassionate. I mean, they may seem so on the surface, but again, if you're not thinking ecologically and spiritually, I think it actually becomes dangerous, because it's empowering people to be stabilized when maybe they need to learn first.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. I mean, I think a lot of what's happening, from the point of view of the brain, is people are deactivating their default mode network, which is just the monkey mind. It's just the endless chatter. And that's exactly what the default mode network is. It's the network that activates when you are not engaged in any particular task.
That's right.
So if you give the brain an intense task, and climbing, free climbing is the ultimate expression of that. Like, you need perfect concentration to do the task. You need to have perfect unbroken concentration.
Yeah.
So you're essentially just creating a context in which that endless chatter in the mind, which you can, from the exact anecdote that you shared, people don't want to be stuck with their own minds.
Yeah.
And here's a way to architect an experience where it will shut that off. But you're right. It's contextual. It's totally based on the circumstances. So you basically have to keep creating those same circumstances. That's basically what we've created in the world, through our devices, through social media, through, all binge watching TV shows. We've basically learned to string together experiences that will deactivate this part of ourselves that creates suffering, rather than learning to manage it.
Yeah,
that isn't contextual.
Yeah, to dispel it, to transcend it. But that's a beautiful place to look at the non-duality of the ecological and spiritual and the inner and the outer. That part of, if you love the world and if you're concerned about the world, it does make a difference when you remove that noise that is quote unquote in your mind that you don't want to look at. And when the feeling we have that when we're by ourselves, I just can't, I would rather torture myself than be with myself. That too is it's like static. in the world that's covering over the symphony that we could be enjoying together. Mm-hmm. If we could just clear every pixel of static you remove, it may not look like much to you, but then the image starts to become clear. If you just, you know, so each of us can kind of do that work and know that it has an effect because of ecologies, because we are interwoven ecologies that are ecology of mind that influences the state of being of others, that self-regulation and co-regulation are not two things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things we're really interested in, you know, from a scientific point of view, because we're, as I mentioned earlier, it's still the infancy in studying these practices and these ideas. There's a couple of interesting things that are coming of it that are kind of the cutting edge right now. One is that we're seeing, and we have some early evidence, that in meditation practices, for example, it's actually not, in the, at least in the early stages, the benefits don't seem to come from the mechanics of the meditation themselves. In other words, if you're, say, doing a mindful breathing practice, that you're training your attention, or if you're doing a compassion practice, that you really are learning to be more empathetic. What our evidence is beginning to show is that actually the benefits at the beginning are from a shift in perspective. Mm. It's actually your mindset that is changing. And, you know, rewiring the attentional networks in your brain eventually will happen. And we certainly have evidence for that as well. But that's a much slower process. But you can change your perspective in an instant. Mm. You can change your mindset in a moment.
Yeah.
And so we, for example, have a study that we've done with school employees, mainly teachers, with a pretty large sample, like 1,000 people. And we have a control group where we use the Healthy Minds app, but we only gave them the lessons, and they actually didn't do the meditations. One group did the full program. So they did both meditation practices and listening to these little podcast style lessons where you hear some kind of insight from the science and from meditative traditions. And then another group who was just getting those lessons and not doing any practice. And there is some difference. There's a little difference in the group who meditates, but a lot of the benefits comes from the perspective shift and the people who are just getting a new perspective on their lives, mm. which is quite interesting. The other thing, going back to the more strengths-based approach, and this is the theme of the book that Richie and Mingyi Rinpoche and I are working on, is this idea of finding everything you think you're looking for and that you think is missing for your life, even in the inner demons, the things that you run from the most. Like, so for me, for anxiety, I used to have a ton of social anxiety, and actually I had a phobia of public speaking. So doing something like this, I would have been in an emotional tailspin as a 19-year-old. Mm-hmm. You couldn't have paid me to like come on a podcast like this. And the intuition is that, oh, I need to get rid of this experience I don't like to be happy. So maybe I'll meditate and that will help me be less anxious. If my anxiety stops, if my phobia doesn't occur, then maybe I could finally be content or happy or whatever it is I think I'm looking for in life. And what some of these traditions are teaching, especially the non-dual traditions, you know, this is very much in Mingyi Rinpoche's lineage from Tibetan Buddhism. The idea is that you don't need to get rid of anything. You actually don't need to change anything about experience. It's rather learning to explore experience and orient to things that we normally are blind to about any experience that we're having, and in particular, difficult experiences. So take anxiety, which is very much the age we're living in. So many people are struggling from anxiety. Actually, there's so much care in anxiety. There's so much insight, actually, in anxiety. I mean, even the ability to imagine the future and try to predict what's happening, there's all sorts of remarkable things that are happening in a moment of anxiety. But when you're caught up in it and you're dominated by it, it's almost like the field of vision narrows. That's where it's toxic. But if you can widen the scope of awareness, and then you can start attuning to some of the beauty and richness that's there in that very experience that is otherwise toxic, you don't need to change anything. And suddenly you're unlocking all sorts of amazing things. And it didn't ask you to feel anything other than what you're already feeling. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something there that we're just beginning to look at scientifically. Of course, this stuff is not new from a meditative point of view and the world's wisdom traditions, but we're really excited about looking at this from a scientific point of view and just seeing, you know, how this impacts people relative to more of like a fix yourself mentality, which is what the current medical system and mental health system is based on.
Yes, exactly. We have to get out of the self-help catastrophe in general, and especially because the self-help catastrophe is that I can get better while the world gets worse. And you have this lovely phrase of shifting from self-improvement to self-discovery, or we could just say to discovery, to co-discovery and co-creation of the world. But yes, to find out about ourselves and to see. And you also have there, in the story that you were telling, Buddha's structure of experience reflected, because the structure of experience is that there's always going to be wisdom, love, and beauty. There's always going to be what you're doing, why you're doing it, and how. Mm-hmm. The beauty dimension is meditation, or as you put it, wisdom, compassion, and awareness. That's just prajna, sila, and samadhi, right? Mm-hmm. So, but this is how every moment of experience has those then in them. And if we begin to shift the view, other things will start to change because of how powerful view is. And then if we begin to cultivate the mind of beauty, which is awareness, then other things, everything really goes together in his analysis of experience and in the way the path is laid out. It's really...
Yeah, I mean, and that all speaks to the importance of being.
Yes.
Because all of that, like, there's no tuning into that. There's no discovering that. There's no tasting that. As long as you're locked in the self-improvement, trying to get to some better experience.
Yes.
Because it's always, you know, it doesn't matter what, how, you know, what happens in your practice, in your life, the underlying assumption is that this moment is not enough and it's not here and I need to kind of get to some other better thing.
Yeah.
And that is the core of the whole mentality. Kind of like you said at the beginning, it's like we all start with there's a problem, and at the end it's like, oh, actually, there is no problem. I gave you a lot of things to do and a lot of hoops to jump through, but that was just to see that actually you were fine from the beginning.
Yeah.
And I think that's so important, because if you look at the environmental stuff, if you look at all the social division and the social problems, so much of that is rooted in an assumption and a feeling of impoverishment. We just feel empty. We need to fill ourselves up. And being, shifting into a state of being, starts helping us see that actually there's so much richness that we just didn't see.
Mm.
That we're not the impoverished, broken things we think we are.
Yeah.
But we need to see that. It doesn't help to believe that.
Right.
You need to feel that, and you need to feel that fullness of being. And then you don't need to endlessly consume. You don't need to come to the world to fill you up. You don't need to look at your relationships to complete you. You know, it's like you're coming to the world feeling full, not overflowing, not even full, overflowing rather than empty and needing to be filled.
Mm.
But I think that's the key with the shift to being, with that developing the inner life, is just helping people see that, to feel that for themselves, because everything else is going to feed on that feeling of impoverishment if we don't learn to see differently.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I'm thinking of, you know, Rumi's poem about how the beloved, when you feel poor, is constantly slipping gold in your pocket and you don't see it.
Mm.
And I mean, so many stories about that, about not realizing the abundance of life and not realizing how wonderful life is. And that too is part of, the spirit of re-indigenizing, to really discover the abundance, to discover the way non-human beings support us, teach us, the way we also rest on the earth like Buddha did, that she's holding us up too, and finding that great treasure that all the wisdom traditions kind of agree. You know, this is a common ground. They all agree that we're just fine. Even the Christian tradition, we're in the image of the divine. We just have to stop resisting it or seeing ourselves incorrectly. To wrap up, I want to try to give a strong recommendation for Joy of Living program and the app. Can you just give some plugs? I mean, isn't this the most popular genre of app, meditation apps? And isn't yours like the highest rated one?
I honestly don't know.
I think you have like 4.9 stars or something. Like,
I mean, we've been very lucky. It's funny because we didn't plan. We originally designed the app for our own research, just because we wanted to ask questions. Like in the app, you know, we have this model of well-being based on these four components of awareness, connection, insight, and purpose, a lot of the stuff we're talking about today. So we wanted to look beyond mindfulness, for example, all of the practices you can do either as sitting meditations or as active practices that you would do when you're going for a walk or commuting. So these were just scientific questions. We wanted to study them, and we never anticipated it was going to take off in the way it did. So it's been very yeah, it's been very heartening to see how people have responded. We have all sorts of research that we've done on it, and also that we've been able to do it for free. I mean, it's completely free. It's totally powered by generosity and donations. There's no paywall or anything.
That's a beautiful thing, everybody. Here's the Healthy Minds app. Let me see if my phone will turn on.
If you just search for Healthy Minds program in any of the
Healthy
app stores.
Minds? Healthy Minds. It's a super cool app and structured around a meaningful life. What would it mean to realize a meaningful and fulfilling life, a life of true well-being, which is what all philosophers promise, actual well-being, health of the soul, and
that's evolving.
Go ahead. Yes.
Evolving. Yeah, the whole thing is designed to be kind of not just we discovered something and now it's out in the world.
Yeah.
But that we actually iterate it and refine it based on what we're learning scientifically. So that's pretty cool. And you also mentioned the Joy of Living. So this is the program of Mingyur Rinpoche in the Theragar community. And I'm maybe the least unbiased person on the planet, but you know, Mingyur Rinpoche is really one of the true living meditation masters alive today. Mm. And he's so incredibly gifted in teaching people how to meditate and just to kind of walk from the very first steps to a very, very deep lifelong practice. So the Joy of Living is, you know, is for my money, just one of the whether, you know, for new meditators or even people who've been meditating a long time, just a profound path of meditation. I first encountered that particular approach after having been meditating for about a decade.
Mm.
It completely, I actually felt confident about my meditation when I first stumbled upon it. And it completely changed everything about my meditation practice. In particular, I would say the big change for me was how much I had been wrestling with my own mind, and I had a kind of an adversarial relationship with my own mind and mental states. And it just completely opened things up. Like, no, like we talked about earlier, you don't need to change anything, but here's how you can explore it.
Yeah.
So Mingyur Rinpoche and the Joy of Living, I can't recommend that enough. It's a really, really helpful program.
Yeah, you do have to pay for it, but it's really inexpensive. You can also write for financial support, assistance, like a scholarship if you want one. And I highly recommend it. I went through it. I think it's just amazing. He is one of the most precious philosophers of our time. Really, really accomplished teacher and yogi and scholar. And he's drawing from really ancient, beautiful, beautiful traditions, streams of practice, and he really does such a good job of making it accessible. It's just brilliantly organized. It's really well done. Same thing with the app is just really, I know you guys got help doing that, and it's just, everything looks great. It is great stuff. So I want to recommend again the book, A Meditator's Guide to Buddhism by Cortland Dahl. You can look up other things Cortland has done. He's done a lot of translation, really good stuff. And Joy of Living program and anything else we can put links. Is there anything else going on that you want to let us know about? Upcoming talk, YouTube event, Theragar event, anything coming up on the horizon?
No, I think we covered it.
We covered it? All right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming, Cort. It was really great to talk to you. I really, really deeply admire and appreciate your work.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And thanks to all of you friends out there. If you have any questions, comments, stories to share about your journey in meditation or spirituality, please send them in through dangerouswisdom.org. We might be able to bring some of them into a future contemplation. Until then, this is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, reminding you that your soul and the soul of the world are not two things. Take good care of them.